Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Hello, I'm Valerie Opapari, and I'm pleased to host today's session, which is part of a three-part series on the role of mentors in academic medicine and pediatrics and specifically. And with our career advisors, the last time we talked about the role of the mentor, the responsibilities of the mentor. We provided some definitions on what the differences are between mentors and sponsors, the differences between a technical mentor and a primary mentor, and of course, the role of master connectors in making things happen for individuals. Today, we're going to turn to the question of how do you measure mentorship success? And I'm really pleased that we have a number of our advisors on the panel today that are going to help address three questions that we're going to pose to them. So I'll start with the first one. And Arnie Strauss, I'm going to ask you to be the first to contribute some comments to this. Mentorship is a core leadership competency. How do you measure mentoring success? Arnie, will you hit us off?
Well, I think it's a long-term issue, of course, but in the short term, I think one can have some indirect measures of success. Perhaps one of the most important is retention of faculty. So if the younger junior faculty are being well mentored and feel that they're valued, they will stay. And I think that's really important because high turnover rate costs money, it costs time, it's stressful, and it makes life difficult for the leadership as well. So retention, I think, is an important measure. And then I would add the typical outcomes of faculty, academic faculty, publications, evaluations, especially in terms of education, but also by patients. Those are the ways that I think one can assess whether the mentor is being effective. And then the third might be that when there's an issue, the mentor successfully deals with it. And that happens more often, or at least in my experience, than one might anticipate. I always liked it when any issues with younger faculty were handled by the mentor, so that as chair, I didn't have to deal with them. Those are ways to assess the quality of mentorship.
Oh, those are all great points. Craig, I see your hand up. Please join the conversation.
It's very difficult to actually come up with quantitative measures for the success of mentorship programs. But I do think that if one imagines themselves from outside the program looking at it, there are some things that one can see in programs that are using mentorship successfully. I think one of the big ones is mentorship being discussed in an open way, in a very affirmative manner, and in a very deliberate manner. Do people have discussions about making sure that what types of mentors are available to folks, that there are different types of mentorships? You know, there's direct mentorship, there's indirect mentorships, there's network mentorships. I mean, there's all types of things which can be helpful to different faculty at different stages in their career. And actual discussions about that is a very healthy symptom that if you look at a program from the outside can really make a difference. Are they part of periodic reviews? Are faculty, when they're having reviews by their division heads or by their department heads, are the role that they're playing as a mentor being specifically addressed in those contexts? And then that becomes important and makes the mentorship more effective and more focused. So I think that's a very good question to make sure that indeed mentors are being fostered appropriately. Does the faculty meeting or the department meeting have explicit discussions about successful mentorships, about those examples, so that other people can role model behavior on ways to become a more effective mentor? And so those are all sort of ways I think that one can actually assess whether or not a particular program has an effective mentorship structure.
Oh, these are great points today. Bob, you have your hand up, please.
I agree with both what Craig and Arnie said. I would add to Arnie's comments that paradoxically, I think when one has effective mentorship in a department, you're actually going to lose some of your more senior faculty as they become attracted to leadership positions elsewhere, and that's actually a product of good mentorship, right? If you can get your associate professors and your full professors to go to other institutions and have leadership roles, that reflects well on the mentorship within your department.
I'd like to follow on something that Craig mentioned, in that mentorship training is very important. I know that these discussions that you're having, Valerie, would be excellent standalone training. And I would also consider assigning a new mentor to an established and a well-regarded senior mentor to provide advice and assistance as they take on this new competency. But in terms of measurement, it's useful to have goals set at the start of the mentorship process and evaluate success based on both the mentor and the mentee's mutual evaluation of success in achieving those goals.
I like that point. That's really critically important to outline what the goals are, to know what you can actually expect to measure. Peggy, comments that you might provide as well to this conversation.
It's a very trusting relationship that has to occur between the mentor and the mentee. And I agree that with Bruce that, you know, it's really important to understand the mentee's perspective as well and have evaluation periods across with probably both about the success of it, especially if you're a new mentor. You know, you set the very formal goals, but you also have informal goals, the communication, the ability to have honest and open communication, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that it's a dual relationship that requires dual evaluation.
The second question that we wanted to get to, there was a little bit of a comment towards this earlier by Craig, but what are common challenges that you've observed in serving as an effective mentor? Craig, you're going to lead us off.
I think that being a mentor is actually tremendously challenging. And one of the things that I've seen in the instances in which I've been a mentor and watching other people be mentors is finding the way to make sure that you take enough time with your mentee, and that it be a very purposeful time, we need to be able to set aside some time in which you listen to the mentee's questions, you listen to the problems that they're engaging in, and meet them on their ground, not the ground that necessarily you decide is important. Although it's important for them to get some of that perspective, you need to be paying attention to them, listening to them, probably doing a lot more listening than talking. And I think that by and large, the mentors that I've seen struggle have had problems being good listeners and problems sitting down and actually helping their mentee feel that they are engaged with that mentee. Because oftentimes people have busy lives or on the run, and it's really important to establish that relationship that they're important enough to have time for them.
Bruder, we haven't heard from you yet, so please provide some perspectives on challenges.
Well, I think what I've observed personally is that one of the challenges is that individuals who are the mentees have a different perspective than what the mentor is hoping to achieve. In other words, the mentees often come to a mentor to solve a specific problem and then see it as more of an individual problem-solving mentor rather than someone who is really seriously involved in their career and moving forward. And then the second challenge is people are so busy finding time and being willing to make those long-term commitments that mentees, again, often see who they consider to be a mentor as someone that episodically, if they have a challenge, rather than someone who they have sit down and talk about their long-term careers. And then one of the challenges is that the people we work with are incredibly accomplished. If you are a mentor and see a mentee that either is having challenges or is headed for problems, finding ways to work with that person in a constructive way to reconsider where they're headed and what they're doing. And again, that takes time and multiple communications and also developing a deep trust. And so I think that in particular was, as a mentor, I found, these incredibly talented, accomplished people that have seldom failed or had someone say, you know, have you thought about this in a different way? And being able to work through that in a constructive way with those individuals. And when you do, it's so satisfying.
I'd like to follow on to something Bruder alluded to. Not all mentorships, relationships are the same. A mentor might be excellent at training lab scientists, but flounder when a mentee chooses to transition away from a research career to a more clinical career. And as well, the chemistry may not develop between the mentor and the mentee. Although you can reassign mentors, before doing that, it's important to understand why there may have been a missed chemistry and have that flexibility. And I would also add that the mentors should be comfortable asking for help. We can't all be experts in everything. They should be able to reach out if they're having difficulty in the mentorship relationship as well.
Maybe we could expand on this just a little bit. I haven't heard yet from any of you setting unrealistic expectations. Does that spur any thoughts kind of related to where we are with challenges?
When you're dealing with a mentee, to establish timelines and to have discussions about those timelines and then to not perhaps be too rigid about them, but to have discussions about them, to know that there is going to be an accountability for this project to be done. I think one of the themes that I've heard coming that I think I might like to be a little more explicit about is it's oftentimes difficult for a mentor to deal with a mentee when things are not going in the right direction. And to be clear that the mentee is hearing that message is something that not very many of us are very good at. And there are different ways to go about doing that. One of them is to make sure that after a discussion, the mentee is given an opportunity to reflect back to the mentor, to you, what it is they heard. Because sometimes we don't do a very good job of letting people know what we think they're doing that is not really appropriate or not really correct or not really in the right direction, and that they need to be changing their course. And that's a very difficult thing that takes some experience and is hard to do sometimes.
I totally agree with Craig. I look at mentorship as a journey, and there's iterations along the way. And I think that, you know, it's based on trust and good communication. And I think the mentor and the mentee both have a responsibility. I think on the front end, you can give the mentee permission to give feedback to the mentor as well, to make sure that they're connecting, that they're on the pathway, or as mentioned, if they want to change course on maybe an area of focus, that the mentor can either say, I'm up for this and I can do it, or to be willing to say, let's find you someone who has more expertise in that particular area. So it really gets down to the open and honest communication and the investment in time.
One of the things I was going to add that when I served as a mentor at the start of, say, the academic year, and you're talking, and what do you want to accomplish this year? The goals are very nonspecific. Helping people rethink and have some specific accomplishments over a certain time period changes what one hopes to occur and out of being a dream into something you can measure.
The last question for the panel today is, how do you identify and address conflicts between mentors and mentees? And I'm going to ask Arnie if you would start us off.
The key is being aware and knowing who's mentoring whom. In smaller departments, that's not so difficult, but sometimes it's very difficult when you have hundreds of faculty, which many chairs, for example, do, or division directors do. So being aware and keeping track, whether it's through indirect things like evaluations or directly by conversations with either the mentee or the mentor. But being aware is absolutely key. And then you can often detect that before anybody brings it to your attention by poor behavior or inadequate behavior by the mentee, not getting to clinic on time, not doing the experiments on time, not fulfilling those specific goals that Bruder mentioned. And if you are aware of what those are, it very much helps you learn quickly that there's an issue. Dealing with the issue is really critical. And I've seen this in all aspects of what we do, but in the research area in particular, because if it's not dealt with immediacy, careers can be wasted and misbehavior continues and becomes learned rather than corrected. Early intervention, I would emphasize, is essential.
I think it's a really interesting point. Misbehavior or inappropriate behavior by a mentor in relation to the mentee. And I think Arnie is absolutely right. I think it's much more, at least in my experience, more common in a closed research environment than it is more in the open clinical environments where more people are involved. I think that you have to maintain the ability of open communication. And when it happens, one needs to be very aggressive in terms of understanding what the situation is and what needs to be done to try and correct it. It's difficult, and it takes experience, actually, I think, as a division chief or a department chair or a dean, whatever, to understand that it's not being overly suspicious to have that some degree of suspicion in almost every instance. Otherwise, you won't realize what's going on. So.
I can think of two specific examples. And one was a terrific young faculty member whose teaching performance was really bad and was probably going to, if continued, be, and I reviewed those each year as chair, a challenge for promotion even. It was that bad. And after meeting with her, it turned out that it was obvious the mentor was frustrated and unhappy and had contributed to her poor performance just by his role modeling. And in that instance, I, you know, suggested some other mentors, but also I hired a coach to work with her specifically on her teaching performance. And she ended up being very successful in trying to provided an alternative to the negative mentorship. The other example that I've seen is, and it's harder to pick up, but sometimes towards the end of fellowship, when you start hearing the lab director or who they consider a mentor to not want to hire them or to be frustrated with someone. And it's been my experience that the laboratory, sometimes the stronger the fellow, the more competitive they become with their mentors, and trying to work through those challenging examples is hard, but trying to find other strong scientists who can connect. But those are two specific areas. Someone who's being a negative mentor that you can pick up by their performance, and the other is harder to detect, but sometimes in the research environment, arguments over who owns a project, whose first publication, those things, those are real issues, and trying to identify them early and try and help people get beyond them is really challenging.
We've talked about these relationships as though they're relatively formal. I think it's also important as department chiefs or division chiefs to create a culture where seeking other mentors is encouraged, not just tolerated, but encouraged. Not that you want mentees, I mean, I agree with the accountability and the responsibility. So you don't want people, trying to avoid that by shopping around, if you will. But I think encouraging a culture where people have multiple mentors and people's careers evolve too. So the type of mentorship they need early in their career might be different than as you yourself become a leader, you're looking for different kinds of mentors. So, you know, having a culture that encourages mentorship and seeking mentorship from other sources, I think is an important part of this as well.
Wesley, you're with us today, and I wondered if we could ask you to provide a few perspectives from the standpoint of recruitment. You have assisted departments, schools, institutions in many levels of recruitment. We were wondering if you had any particular perspectives about how to mentor new leaders and new recruits at an institution, and perhaps in the context of onboarding them successfully.
Great question, Valerie. I guess from our perspective, I acknowledge and agree that no two mentor programs are the same. I mean, every institution we work with has a different spin on how that's defined and how they implement that. I do think from a recruiting perspective, an established mentorship program that, you know, people a candidate is engaging with as part of a leadership process who are part of that program, either who are mentors in that program or have been, you know, a mentee and successfully, you know, had that program impact their careers are great people to put in front of candidates, because it just demonstrates a commitment to the candidate, to their long-term well-being beyond what's in the contract, and, you know, how people use the mentorship program to deal with problems. From a recruiting perspective, it's important. I think it speaks to the culture of the department and to the, you know, the support both from the Children's Hospital and the department as it relates to a candidate's well-being.
The hospital has an obligation as much as the department does in mentoring junior faculty and helping them sort of understand parts of medicine that may not have been sort of central to their training. And so any opportunity that I've ever had to work with junior faculty to provide them some understanding and mentorship from the hospital perspective, I think it's invaluable. And I think it's something that all junior faculty should take advantage of, because I think it takes a village. It takes all of us to mentor people to become great leaders in the future. And the only other point I was going to mention, sort of listening to all of the other great comments, was, you know, there's formal mentors and there's informal mentors. And I think you always have to understand as a more senior person that your relationship may be more of an informal mentorship. You know, the benefit they get from you, looking to you as sort of a role model, per se, is an opportunity that they're reaching out to you to mentor them. And I think it's important to stay cognizant of that as well.
This has been a great conversation, because mentorship is so important, and it's an obligation on the part of the mentor and the mentee to have a successful relationship. I agree with John in terms of there's also an administrative role in leadership that pretty much saddles within the hospital structure. So I think we have a tremendous obligation to work collaboratively and co-mentor those individuals that want to rise in to be, you know, division chiefs, department chairs, et cetera, because to understand the dynamics of how the hospital environment works is incredibly important. And there's mystique in all of it. And I think really identifying those people early who really do want to be on that dual career path, whether it's either science and clinical or administrative and clinical, we really need to take them under our wing and teach them early and often. And so I think that department leaders, clinical leaders, really do have a role on the part of the hospital to work very collaboratively in a co-mentoring environment.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. So this was the second part in our series. I'll try and summarize a few of the kind of main points from today, which was focused on how do you measure successful mentoring? How do you deal with challenges? And how do you deal with mentor-mentee relationships that are not going as you would expect. So it's clear that there are metrics we can use, turnover, retention, how successful candidates are at the junior point in their career with plans for publications, their promotions, if they meet promotion objectives of the institution, the quality of their evaluations and how they speak to the candidates' accomplishments. We heard that mentorship has to be deliberate, that there are many types of mentorship, and that it evolves, that it's a journey. And over the course of your career, you will need different individuals to support your career development. We heard very importantly that as part of the measuring, you need to have periodic reviews. You need to have meetings, faculty meetings, where you talk about mentorship and give examples of successful role models and individuals who have accomplished great things through their mentorship efforts. Another metric that was mentioned is how many of your faculty actually get recruited into leadership roles. That's a direct reflection on how you and your institution has supported an individual to become competitive for these positions. Informal, formal goals, whether or not individuals have met these expectations, and are the expectations that are set forward that are going to be measured, are they realistic? And then lastly, I think we heard really importantly that beyond the primary technical mentors that you have within your departments, you also have a community of leaders within your children's hospitals that are there to help support you in your mentorship goals and your journey to success. And then lastly, I think we heard a lot of great strategies around identifying and dealing early with problems in behaviors or accomplishments that are not meeting goals, and how important listening and effective communication are, that's open, regular, and clear, to getting things back on course as early as you possibly can. So I'd like to again thank our panelists, and I look forward to our third conversation in mentorship that will be coming up soon. Again, thank you all for your perspectives, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. The Child Health Advisory Council includes the following members: Bruder Stapleton, Craig Hillemeyer, Arnold Strauss, Peggy Troy, Valerio Papari, Danielle LaRocarina, Robert Sawin, and Bruce Rubin. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.